Hello, I'm Bob Dorigo Jones. This is number 0308, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
There, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0308. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Mark Hartzman, who is the author of The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell, a memoir.
Once I had the idea of writing a memoir, I got very excited. To write a book from the perspective of a head was just, I thought, really intriguing. So that got me really energized. And, you know, I outlined, as I was saying, the true history of the head, but then all these other bits of history were just falling into place. And as I was writing, knowing I had to get from one point to another, it was almost writing itself, which was really interesting. I would find little stories and little tidbits that would just weave themselves right into the story. So a lot of things were just working out beautifully for me, and it was really a fun project for me to write.
Laura Doyle is the author of First Kill All the Marriage Counselors. So, what does she have against marriage counseling?
Well, I think it's a very old technology, if you will. I mean, I think most of it's based on Jung and Freud, and it's like, you know, not just the last millennium, but kind of way back in the last millennium. And I mean, some of the structures of it are just really ineffective. I mean, no couple ever got happier by complaining about each other for 1 hour a week.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. How does he feel about the competition? You know, Uber.
The owners of these garages, their happy crooked days are over, and they've been replaced by a different set of thieves. What happened in this instance is that when Uber hit New York City, the first thing they did is hire the deputy commissioner of the Taxi and Limousine Commission. Then by teaching them every trick in the book, he was able to con the city into releasing more licenses specifically for Uber, which they did. 20,000 licenses. And the question might come up, did we really need that many more cabs? And I would tell you, yeah, you really didn't.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0308, was Bob Dorigo Jones, senior fellow at Center for America and the host of Let's Be Fair, which you can hear on this program a little later on, as you can each and every week we do the Stuff File program. And thank you very much, Bob, for doing the guest Slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, an audience member apparently got caught up in the illusion of live theater at a Broadway show and stunned onlookers by trying to charge his phone on stage. Cast members and theatergoers at the July 2nd showing of the adult puppet play Hand to God said the man climbed on stage before the start of the show and attempted to charge his phone in an electrical outlet. Witnesses said the man's attempt failed as the outlet was a non-functioning part of the show set, and workers quickly arrived to unplug the phone and make an announcement about not using the set for charging. "Well, where am I going to charge it?" the man was quoted as saying by the blog Broadway Adjacent. Really? That's what he said? Yeah. Cast members Sarah Stiles and Mark Kudich talked about the incident on Twitter. One tweet goes, "A guy jumped on the stage and plugged his phone into a fake outlet on our set just before we started at Hand to God B-Way. Hashtag full moon or hashtag idiot." That was Stiles' tweet. "Dear general audience, an electrical socket that's a part of the set of the play is not for you to charge your phone, just an FYI." That's what Kudich wrote in his tweet. Witnesses said the man was not kicked out of the play and had been drinking at the bar during intermission. I'm thinking maybe he was drinking before intermission too, but that's just me. Some suggested the incident may have been a dare from someone attending the play with the man. Now, some might say that this person would be a classic example of idiot of the day, as one of the actors actually alluded in the hashtag, that was mentioned a few moments ago, but I disagree. This isn't an idiot. This is just a thoughtless, callous moron with no regard for those around him, and clearly he is the center of his own universe. Now just look at his own quote as an example. Where am I going to charge it? Just the rudeness of being able to use someone else's electricity without asking proves that he was raised without any manners. I've seen the video of him crawling up on stage. You can find it online, by the way. And I think it takes a large set of stones to even follow through with this one. If I were to nominate an idiot of the day in this case, it would not be the guy who climbed up on stage. It would be the theater management who didn't throw his butt out when they had the chance to do so. I mean, what a complete pinhead this guy is. But again, he's not the idiot of the day. That comes on the program later. Don't get me started. I just get riled up for people like this. I used to work in a theater when I was a teenager. And, you know, we didn't put up with crap that took place. And I was in a movie theater, not even a live performance theater. We didn't put up with any kind of crap that people would do in a theater. You did something stupid, we bounced your ass. That's basically how it works. Why it's not that way anymore, I don't know. Anyway, let's move along, shall we? Actually, we have a Darwin file story, so you know how this ends, don't you? Yes, because the tree of life is often self-pruning. 49-year-old Charles Cooper was drinking beer on his property in Mims, Florida, with a woman as part of a fishing trip. At one point, the woman says Cooper pulled out a pistol, removed the magazine, and then wondered aloud whether there was still a round in the chamber. Yeah, you're already ahead of me, aren't you? Mm-hmm. Cooper then raised the gun to his head and pulled the trigger, the resulting Volusia County Sheriff's Office report notes. The answer? Yes, there was a round in the chamber. Cooper was pronounced dead at the scene. The sheriff's office has ruled the shooting an accident. Actually, it's just thinning of the herd is what that is. But the real surprise in this story is by doing something so absolutely moronic, you wonder how he reached 49 years of age. Because people who are this, you know, thick-skulled, with the exception of a bullet, of course, usually find a way of removing themselves from the planet much earlier. But anyway, I digress. A Chinese man turned his pets over to an animal rescue group after the two puppies, and I'm doing air quotes here, that he adopted 2 years ago, grew up to be Asian black bears. Wang Qiu of Yunnan province said he adopted the two puppies from Vietnam about 2 years ago, and when the animals began to grow, he discovered they were actually bears. Wang, actually, it's probably pronounced Wong, I'm guessing, said the animals were very well behaved, and he kept them at his home until he recently saw a leaflet about endangered animals from a local public security bureau and discovered that his pets were actually Asian black bears, a Category 2 protected species. The bears were taken June 30th to the Hunan Wild Animal Rescue Center, where officials confirmed that they were a male and female Asian black bears, also known as moon bears, by the way. A spokesman for the center said both animals were in good health. Okay. I've seen pictures of Asian black bears at various ages of their development, from cubs to 2 years old. And you know what they look like? They look like bears. Has this guy perhaps not actually seen what puppies look like in his life? How do you confuse bear cubs for puppies? First of all, bear cubs start off bigger than puppies. But anyway, again, don't get me started. Let's just move along to our next story, shall we? 85-year-old Douglas Legler of Fargo, North Dakota, died, and his obituary in the Fargo Forum said it all. Doug died. That's the entire text of the obit. He said over and over, when I die, I want my obituary to say, Doug died, reports his daughter, Janet Stoll. When her father would read obits, they would say he was the president of this, a director of that, and Dad would say, what, couldn't they hold down a job? Stoll admits her dad had several jobs, including driver, vending machine repairman, and farm equipment painter. He also liked to sing and took the occasional trip to the casino. You know, I myself love Doug's sense of economy, but his two-word obituary is exactly two words longer than mine will be, because there won't be one. Waste of time, as far as I'm concerned. If you haven't heard or seen me for a period of time, consider me dead and move on. Okay? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 42-year-old An Nguyen was buying a purse at Macy's in Newark, California. Now, according to police, Nguyen complained about the price and received a discount on the purse, but was still angry about the price and started screaming and cursing at the manager. The manager and loss prevention officers asked Nguyen to leave. She refused, so one of the officers attempted to escort her from the store. According to the report, Nguyen then threw herself on the floor in a full-blown temper tantrum, scratching and biting the officer on the leg. The store detective was treated for minor injuries, and Nguyen was arrested for assault and battery. Of course, you know, lost in this story is the fact that now she doesn't get the purse. So that temper tantrum was for naught, really. I mean, she's 42 years old. She must have been just a delightful child. Delightful, huh? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? We've had Mark Hartzman on the show before, back when his book, God Made Me Do It, came out. Now he has a new one with a rather interesting title. It's called The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell, A Memoir. And Mark joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for being on the program with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm almost afraid to ask how this idea came to be.
Well, you know, actually, it came to be after I read a book about phrenology and the head of Joseph Haydn. And Haydn's head had actually been taken from his grave and studied by some phrenologists in the early days of phrenology, which was when people thought they could study the shape of the skull, the mounds and bumps and ridges along the skull, to figure out somebody's personality. And at the time, they could only get heads or skulls from executed criminals. And a friend of Joseph Haydn was very into phrenology and knew his friend Haydn was very old and was going to die soon. And if he could get that head, he would be able to study the head of a genius. And then he could compare the head of a genius to criminals. So he managed to do that. Anyway, the head, it's a longer story, but to make a long story short, the head traveled around Austria and Europe for over 140 years before being returned to the grave. So I found this very fascinating. I started researching other stories of posthumous adventures of body parts and came across the head of Oliver Cromwell. So Haydn's head, I thought, was amazing with 140 plus years traveling, but Cromwell's traveled for 300 years, from 1661 to 1960, before it was reburied at Sidney Sussex College in Cambridge. So once I found that, I thought, I have to write a story about this, and thought doing a memoir of the head's adventures would be a really fun challenge and adventure. So the whole story is written from the head's point of view.
Well, that was my next question. You've written this book from the head's point of view. To pardon the pun, that's a very heady way of doing it.
Yeah, well, it gave me a chance to, you know, just take on this voice and have these different observations of all these amazing bits of history that it went through. I mean, from 1661 to 1960, we're covering an amazing chunk of history. You know, he saw Cromwell, just for a quick background, he was the one who led the charge to behead Charles I in 1649 and end the British monarchy. He became Lord Protector of England, Ireland, and Scotland. Until his death, he was buried and embalmed in Westminster Abbey. And then his body was exhumed when Charles II resumed the monarchy. So that was the restoration. And then he beheaded him, hung him and beheaded him in public. So this head observed, you know, theoretically. I know dead heads aren't really observing anything, but it was there for the Great Plague, the Great Fire of London, in the 1660s, and then went on to just see all this amazing history through various kings and queens and Revolutionary War, World War I, World War II. Lots of odd bits. You know, I talked about the rise of spiritualism. You know, I let the head go into a seance where they were trying to speak to the spirit of Cromwell. But the head was right there hearing the whole thing, but obviously can't communicate with the spiritualist because that's a phony science like phrenology. In fact, Cromwell's head was studied by a phrenologist, and so he does have that adventure in the book. So he's able to encounter all these odd characters, real events and odd characters throughout history.
So before you had the idea of writing this memoir, when you focused on Oliver Cromwell's head, how much studying did you have to do of either the actual life of Oliver Cromwell or his head's post-life, so to speak?
Well, I did a lot of both. So the book is clearly more about the post-life. So there's several books on the subject. There's lots of articles on the subject. So I was able to map out the true history, basically, you know, when the head came off of Westminster Hall, it fell off during a big rainstorm, just fell off the post. It broke in half. It was picked up by a sentry, taken home. The guy hid it in his chimney until he was on his deathbed. At that point, he let his family know he had the head of Cromwell in the house, and then went to a museum operator, a very early cabinet of curiosities in London. From there, it went to another family, descended through a few generations, was then sold to another man who was a collector, and then passed through a few other hands until eventually it landed into the family, a family called Wilkinson, and it lasted five generations through that family. So I was able to track all these different hands it passed through. And from there, it was just sort of a matter of weaving in different details and a few imagined anecdotes along the way. Clearly, there's not history recorded for every moment of that 300 years. So I did have to add a few moments of my own, which were kind of fun ways to bring in other odd bits of history, as I mentioned, and different characters, real characters of history, to encounter the head. I did a lot of studying about his life as well because I wanted to have some background throughout the book. So there's a point where his head actually reaches the place where he grew up. So he's able to then reminisce about his childhood and get into how he rose to the position he got to. So it definitely gets into his history, but it's mostly about his observations and is able to touch on, like I said, these different bits of history. So the book isn't just about Cromwell, but it is about just European history and the different events that were occurring.
Okay, so when you come up for an idea with a book like this, you're never quite sure, I'm sure, when you first put pen to paper or, you know, fingers to keyboard, if you're really on to something, and then you start doing all the research. Was there an aha moment when you were doing your research saying, oh, I'm really on to something here?
Well, once I had the idea of writing a memoir, I got very excited because for me creatively, that was just a really interesting place to be. To write a book from the perspective of a head was just, I thought, really intriguing. So that got me really energized. And you know, I outlined, as I was saying, the true history of the head, but then all these other bits of history were just falling into place. And as I was writing, knowing I had to get from one point to another, it was almost writing itself, which was really interesting. I would find little stories and little tidbits that would just weave themselves right into the story. So a lot of things were just working out beautifully for me. It was really a fun project for me to write.
So after you've written the book, and I don't know the process, if you were commissioned to write this book or you wrote this book and then got a publisher, but which came first, chicken or the egg, publisher or book?
Oh, it was more the doing the book first.
Doing the book first. Okay, that's what I thought. So you write this book and then you get a publisher. Was there any double takes? Look, I've got this great idea. It's a book. It's a memoir by Oliver Cromwell's head. Were there any double takes along the way?
Well, it's one of these subjects, you know, it's definitely odd and unusual. It's not the first book written on the head, but the other books written on the head are all fact-based, certainly not from the perspective of the head. So it's, you know, it's an unusual bit of history, but yeah, it got some, I think some people were raising their eyebrows and not so sure. Not the everyday story.
Now, as you know, there are some people in the UK, scholars and the like, who really have no sense of humor. Have you heard from anybody, yay or nay, from the UK about this book?
I haven't yet, but it's just out, so I am curious to see what they think. I know that Cromwell is kind of one of those polarizing figures. Some people think he's a hero, some people think he's a villain, so that it's probably going to be a matter of who's seeing it and what their thoughts on the subject are. I did go to London to do a lot of research, actually up to Cambridge. I mean, that history is such an important part of English history. But in Cambridge, I was able to go to Sydney Sussex College, where Cromwell went for 1 year, and that's where the head is buried now. So I was able to go through their archives, which was really a wonderful experience. They have just a big folder just stacked with all kinds of articles, letters, clippings that go back to the late 1700s. So I was able to go through all that to do a lot of research, got some great photos of some of those artifacts. And I do need to send it to them. I want to let them know that the book is done and it's out. And I'm a little curious to see what they think. Hopefully they like it. Hopefully they find it enjoyable. It's probably not what they were expecting because they probably thought it would be a little bit more of a scholarly take. But I hope they'll like it.
Well, I was about to ask, when you were over there, what did you tell them that you were writing?
Well, I told them I was writing a book on Oliver Cromwell's head. So I didn't give them much more detail than that. But I did need to, I had to have my agent write to them. And it was a bit of a process to get access. They weren't just ready to let anyone walk into that room. So I was fortunate to finally get access. And they were very friendly and accommodating once we got there.
So the book is now out, and I'm almost afraid to ask, what are you thinking about writing next?
Well, I'm still trying to decide. You know, initially I thought it'd be fun to write the same kind of story from Joseph Haydn's head and do his perspective and get a little bit of a series of deadhead books going. But I'm not sure right now. This one's taken a while. It was a long process. So I need to think a little bit about what the next venture will be for me.
Well, I think you've certainly discovered a very interesting and particular niche that you can definitely run with. The book is called The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell, A Memoir, and it's written by Mark Hartzman. And there's a website for the book. I believe it's curiouspublications.com. Is that correct?
That's right.
Thank you very much, Mark, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. I appreciate it.
Mark Hartzman, author of The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell, A Memoir. You can go to my website at thestuffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0308, and you'll find the links to the website that Mark mentioned a few moments ago, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you. 1, 2, 3.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of First Kill All the Marriage Counselors. Plus, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. And we do indeed have an idiot of the day. That's all coming your way a little later on in this program. A program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But we have more stuff file news for you right here, right now. In May, police in Anglesey, which is in North Wales, called for a hostage negotiator to help with two suspects, aged 21 and 27, who were wanted for a series of relatively minor crimes and who were holed up on the roof of a building. However, the building was a one-story community center, and the men, whose feet were dangling over a gutter about 8 feet off the ground, had refused to come down. When the crowd gathered to watch, the men still managed to hold out and stick around on that roof for about 90 minutes before being talked down. Seriously, only 8 feet off the ground? I would have given the entire crowd straws with peas. That's what I would have done. Just to continuously pelt these clowns with their pea shooters, just to get them down faster. I mean, how well would the hostage negotiators, and again, doing air quotes here, handle a real high-rise standoff? I mean, the guy's 8 feet off the ground. Just grab his feet and pull him down. Not that hard. India Lomas's stepfather bought a plane ticket for Batman, but he didn't know it. He just copied the name from his stepdaughter's boyfriend's Facebook profile, where Adam Armstrong had borrowed the surname in jest from actor Adam West, who played the Caped Crusader on TV, as you all know. Irish discount carrier Ryanair wouldn't let Armstrong correct his name without paying £220. That's about $345 US. So to escape the fee, the student from Manchester, England, did something cheaper. He changed his name to West and got a new passport. Now, with rush service, the passport cost only £103. Okay, so now that we've heard this story, any suggestions for a new name for Ryanair, who went to the asinine nth degree of not changing the ticket unless this guy paid close to $350 US? How about Pinhead Airline? That comes to mind. Or how about Gouge Air? Yeah, that works for me. That works for me a lot. Let's go to Arab, Alabama. Interesting town name, don't you think? Arab, Alabama. Sheriff's officials in northern Alabama say a burglary suspect was taken into custody after being chased by a bull through a cow pasture. Marshall County Sheriff Scott Walls said 26-year-old Brad Lynn Hemby was being sought in connection with a burglary in Arab, Alabama. Walls said Hemby tried fleeing deputies by running through a cow pasture, and a bull roaming the land joined the chase. Hemby eventually fell onto a barbed wire fence, oh, that's gotta hurt, and surrendered. Stolen property was recovered from Hemby's truck, and the man was charged with burglary, theft, and attempting to elude. Ah, yes, thwarted in crime by a load of bull. How sweet, how fitting. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. About three-fourths of the 1,580 IRS workers found to have deliberately attempted to evade federal income tax during the last 10 years have nonetheless retained their jobs, according to a May report by the agency's inspector general. Some even received promotions and performance bonuses, although an internal rule adopted last year now forbids such bonuses to want a judge to owe back taxes. Oh, the irony. You know, I guess some people treat taxes the same way they treat sports. If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. That's probably their axiom over there at, you know, the IRS. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. According to a study at UCLA by professors of psychology, 75% of couples who get traditional behavioral marriage counseling are separated within a year. It's a statistic like that which brought us intimacy expert and best-selling author Laura Doyle. Her latest book is entitled First Kill All the Marriage Counselors. Laura joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I'm taking it that your book is not on the shelves of most offices of marriage counselors.
Well, you know, you might be surprised. They sure call my offices a lot asking for help with their marriages. I'm not making that up.
Now why is it you think that, according to this study anyway, that marriage counseling isn't necessarily what helps a marriage if 75% of couples get separated within a year?
Well, I think it's a very old technology, if you will. I mean, I think most of it's based on Jung and Freud, and it's like, you know, not just the last millennium, but kind of way back in the last millennium. And I mean, some of the structures of it are just really ineffective. I mean, no couple ever got happier by complaining about each other for 1 hour a week, for example. So that's one of the pitfalls of marriage counseling. And here's another one that I, unfortunately, this is exactly what I did when I first dragged my husband to marriage counseling many years ago. And that was, I took him there thinking, God, if only he would change, if only he would straighten up, that I could finally be happy. So I was just there waiting for the marriage counselor to make him change, you know, to improve him. And I was there as a dutiful wife, sort of supporting the process, but I didn't really see myself as needing to do anything differently. I thought I was already working really hard in the relationship, and he was the problem. So that's another common thing that I think happens at marriage counseling, is it's easy to kind of shift the blame over to the other person. But the third thing that I think is really the clincher for me was that when I went, one of the things I learned about myself is that I was controlling. You know, I used to tell my husband what to wear and how to drive and, you know, what to eat for lunch and what to do at work. And I thought I was just being helpful. I think helpful in wife language, which equals critical in husband language, is a pretty common scenario in a lot of relationships. And I remember my counselor pointing it out. You know, she's like, yeah, you're controlling. And I was like, okay, I get it. All right. Yeah, I can see where that's not helping things. And I said, what do I do? And she said, yeah, just stop being controlling. You know, just stop. Like, stop thinking about elephants. And it wasn't very helpful for me. And looking back, you know, in retrospect, she just didn't have those skills to pass on to me. And that's been my experience with marriage counseling in general. I mean, in my position as a relationship coach, I unfortunately hear quite a few horror stories, and it's taken me all this time, it's taken me 16 years of being a relationship coach to be willing to say that marriage counseling doesn't work. It gives me no pleasure to say so. I think they're mostly good people that mean well. But because I'm on a mission to end world divorce, and I've helped over 150,000 women revitalize their relationships, you know, really make them playful and passionate again, I feel like somebody's got to stand up and say something. And so here I am saying, not only does this not work, there is a proven way, and it's called the Six Intimacy Scales.
Okay, well, we'll get to that in a moment. But going back to marriage counseling, isn't part of the problem the fact that both people have got to want to go to marriage counseling and make things work? Because as you just described earlier, wasn't it a situation where you dragged your husband there? Isn't someone always being dragged?
Someone's always being dragged. It is usually the husband. And in my experience, it actually does not take two to improve the marriage. It only takes one, but it has to be the wife. So we wives have amazing power to single-handedly improve the relationship. And just like we learned from Spider-Man, Peter, with great power comes great responsibility. So I really believe we have a responsibility to learn these intimacy skills to make our relationships great and to make them what we dreamed of having as a little girl, because that's the foundation of the family and all of our communities and our country and the world. So I think, you know, part of my message is to say to women, hey, great news, this thing that you care so deeply about, you've got a lot of power and influence that you don't even know about, and I'd love to show you what those gifts are so you can use them to your benefit and to your whole family's benefit.
But as you described earlier, the brains are different between the man and the woman, the thinking about how certain things are. So by you saying it takes one to make the marriage work, in a man's mind, aren't you just saying to him, well, you're off the hook?
Yeah, he's off the hook. He is off the hook with me. In fact, In this book, First Kill All the Marriage Counselors, there's one page that I think is beneficial for men. It's page 73. And other than that, I actually just wrote a blog on how they can maybe invite their wives to read the book, because they really don't. Here's what's great about men, Peter. Men, and this is was an amazing discovery that I made that really is the key to having a great relationship again, and that is that men just want their wives to be happy. In fact, Peter, are you married?
No, I'm not.
You're not married. Okay. You've been married.
No, I have not.
Never been married. Okay. Nope. You've had girlfriends.
A few.
I'm striking out here. Okay.
Yeah, you're striking out completely.
So when you were in a relationship, how important was it to you that your girlfriend was happy?
Very.
Okay. And so I've asked thousands of men that question, and they all say the same thing. They say very. They say it's everything. It's the only thing. It's imperative. And so, and this is what I love about men, is they are always really looking for their opening to make us happy. They have that hero gene, and they just want to delight us if we'll give them a chance. And so that's part of why we have so much power as women, is he's already got that predisposition. And all we have to do is be pleasable and grateful and appreciative, and also, we've got to bring some respect to the relationship. That respect is like oxygen for men. And because it looks so different to women than it does to men, that's the part that takes a little training. And so what I was fascinated by was that great relationships are like everything else in life. You need a little bit of a lesson in order to get good at it. So we don't just throw the keys to a 16-year-old and say, here's your car, go drive around. No, we insist that they get some driving lessons first and then take a test. And in a way, relationships are the same way. You know, if you don't get any lessons, you're going to crash and say, whoa, relationships are hard and they're dangerous. And once you find out the skills, they're not hard work at all. Now my marriage is my soft place to land. It's where I get to find out that I'm beautiful and I'm amazing and I'm wonderful and I'm the most special woman in the world. And that's not hard work at all, now that I know what I'm doing.
Okay, but let me get into the guy's head again. You just described earlier, what do you want in your relationship? And that is to make your mate happy. I find with some guys that changes over the years. And what it is their definition of happy is just keeping their spouse quiet, i.e. not nagging.
Yeah, exactly. That's the title of my new blog that's going to be posted this week. It's called How to Get Your Wife to Stop Nagging. And I agree that there's a posture that men will take. My husband had it, which was he was watching a lot of television because he was trying to avoid me, because I'd just become this unpleasant, controlling shrew, nagging shrew. And they will react to their wives that way. But here's the magic that I've seen too many times to deny it, and that is that the minute she changes it up, the minute she relinquishes that inappropriate control using my world-famous system, where I don't just say, stop being controlling. You know, I have a whole step-by-step plan that I use in my own marriage and that 150,000 other women all over the world have used. As soon as she does that, that natural instinct to make her happy is right there. We had one woman was talking about how she had just finished her Zumba class at the gym, and she called her husband and said, there was this downpour. She said, I'm going to wait until the downpour ends because it's just, wow, it's really raining hard right now. And he said, I'll be right over with an umbrella. And he did. He came to the gym with an umbrella, walked up to the gym door, walked her to her car with this umbrella, and she said, you would have thought I was made of sugar, that he was being so careful not to get any rain on her. And this was after they'd been married for 20 years. It was mostly a estranged and distant relationship. So right away, as soon as he saw his opportunity to make her happy, he was there being very chivalrous.
So chivalry isn't dead. It's just in a coma.
Wait, say it again. It's what?
I said, so chivalry isn't dead. It's just in a coma.
It's just, it's right there if you want it. My husband's incredibly chivalrous, and he does all kinds of things. He can't do enough to make me happy. And sometimes it's almost, it makes you feel a little vulnerable because you're getting so much from your husband or your boyfriend, and it takes a little bit of getting used to tell you the truth. But it's wonderful. It's amazing. We were at a breakfast cafe recently, where, and I've been married for 25 years, and I was just kind of people watching, and he goes, oh, don't move. And he gets out his phone to take my picture, like I'm, you know, a supermodel or something. And then he hands me the phone and says, look how beautiful you are. And I'm looking through the phone. It's all pictures of me. It's pictures of Laura in the backyard, Laura making dinner. And I can't tell you, it's such an inner strength to have that. I mean, we very nearly got divorced back in the early days before I had any skills. And I just am so grateful every day that I, you know, was able to ask some wise older women for their advice on how to have a happy relationship and then do some experimenting in my own marriage. And I didn't take that path. And I'm so grateful every day that I'm still married to the love of my life.
Well, I was going to say that you are a very lucky woman, but I won't. I'll say your husband's a very lucky man.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think we both consider ourselves really fortunate to live with the benefit of these skills.
People can find out more information by going to your website, which is lauradoyle.org. And the book, again, is called First Kill All the Marriage Counselors. And you say you have a new book coming out?
That's it. First Kill All the Marriage Counselors is my brand new book. And we have a Get Cherished challenge going on right now. So you go to getcherished.com and sign up for that for free. And it'll send you every day for 5 days. It'll give you a specific exercise or action item to try so that you can start feeling cherished, let's say, by the weekend.
And that website again is?
It's getcherished.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Laura, for being on the program with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Laura Doyle, author of First Kill All the Marriage Counselors. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0308, and you'll find the links to Laura's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. After we announced the finalists in our Wacky Warning Labels contest, we got calls from all over the world. Reporters in Germany, France, Korea, and Japan who want to feature the contest. They all ask the same thing. Why are there so many common sense warnings on products sold in America? The answer is that anyone who sells a product here knows they can be sued over almost anything, so these warnings are meant to prevent frivolous lawsuits. Like when a guy who was playing basketball caught his teeth in the net while dunking the ball and sued the net makers. He got $50,000. In another case, a toolmaker was sued by a man who used one of their wood routers to try to fix his own teeth. That company eventually put a label on the tool warning that it's not intended to be used as a dental drill. Now, let's be fair, these warnings can be hilarious, but the fact that product makers have to put them there because they're facing so many abusive lawsuits is nothing to laugh about. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And from the city that never sleeps, we do indeed have Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, live from the streets of New York.
Always a pleasure to have you on the program. And I'm wondering, do we need to take up a collection for you? I understand the value of a New York City taxi medallion has started to drop a little bit thanks to Uber.
Well, that's a nice offer, but I don't own a New York City cab. Most drivers do not own cabs, and as a matter of fact, I should take a moment out to explain to you exactly how the system works. We have approximately 13,000 yellow cabs on the streets of New York, which, by the way, is the same number of cabs, basically, that we had in 1938. The city might need more cabs, but the people who own the cabs certainly don't want more cabs. I mean, it's just a way of life. So, through the years, by making huge underhanded payoffs to the city fathers, the taxi industry has been able to keep a lock on the number of cabs. Completely crooked and unethical. So, what happens is that if somebody wants to drive a cab like me, you go into a garage and you lease the cab for a 12-hour shift. It would be from 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. or 5 p.m. to 5 a.m. I would have to pay, let's say, $120 for the shift, and then I'd have to fill the car up with gas. So you're talking about maybe by the time you're finished, you've invested $150 into your shift. All of the money you make past that $150 is yours to keep. So that's the way it goes, basically. Well, the owners of these garages, and there's 13 of them in New York, their happy crooked days are over, and they've been replaced by a different set of thieves. What happened in this instance is that when Uber hit New York City, the first thing they did is hire the deputy commissioner of the Taxi and Limousine Commission, who left his job and went to work for Uber. Then by teaching them, I'm talking about the management of Uber, every trick in the book, he was able to con the city into releasing more licenses specifically for Uber, which they did. 20,000 licenses. That's what we have. So we have the original 13,000, and now we have another 20,000. That's a big jump. And the question might come up, did we really need that many more cabs? And I would tell you, you really didn't. So the whole thing is really crooked. And because of that, anybody who does own a cab, and I don't have great sympathy for the garages, the value of their taxi medallion has gone down because instead of having 13,000 competitors, they now have 33,000 competitors. And that makes a big difference if you're thinking of buying one. Bottom line is, don't buy one.
And we should mention the value of a medallion is somewhere around $800,000.
Well, I don't know who's saying that. Anybody who would buy a medallion today would be out of their mind, because all the city would do is add another 20,000 Ubers, or maybe another 40,000 Ubers. Every time they add an Uber cab, the value of the medallion for the yellow cab is going to go down. And by the way, that does it the same for all the Uber drivers. Because the Uber drivers in the beginning said, oh, this is going to be neat. There's going to be 10,000 of us. And before they knew it, there were 15,000 of them. Now there's 20,000 of them. Another week, maybe there'll be 40,000. So it's not only the value of the yellow cab that's dropping drastically, it's the value of the Uber car that's also dropping drastically.
Wow. It can have a definite effect on a certain part of the economy. And speaking of economy, I wanted to talk to you about what's happening in Greece, because I understand you know for a fact that it's kind of affecting people who are from Greece or are Greek nationals who are in New York.
Yeah, well, first of all, other than their concerns about what's going on back home, they suddenly found that their credit cards didn't work here. The way we found out about it is we had another number of incidences where people would get into the cab, give a destination. When they get to the destination, the taxi driver would try to swipe the card, and it didn't work. And we realized there was a consistent pattern, that it wasn't that all of a sudden everybody became a dusty. It was that anybody who had a credit card where its home of origin was Greece was not going to work. So we had to come up with a policy. What do we do when some guy from Greece gets into a cab, asks you to take him someplace, like the airport, and then all of a sudden he and the driver find out that the credit card doesn't work? Well, the policy in our garage was just to forget about it. That's it. What are you going to do? You're going to take the guy to jail? And in every instance where this happened, it wasn't some kind of a con job or a wind-up where the guy got into the cab, knowing that the cab, that the credit card was no good. It was a legitimate error on their part. So you can thank that for the banks. You know the banks. The banks who destroy economies.
Yes.
You know the ones I'm talking about, don't you?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And speaking of banks, I understand somebody tried to rob one recently in New York, and he didn't quite get away.
This got to be the crime of the week. And I have a picture of it on my website, gabby.com. The guy did it in the wheelchair. That's really, a lot of nerve, I think. So he wheels himself into the bank, tells everybody to stick him up. They give him some money. as he starts to go down the street, I don't know how far he thought he was going to get, one of the wheels in the wheelchair got lost. I see here the makings of a movie. And, of course, the cops caught him. So the moral to any of their younger audience that's considering a life of crime, I don't think you ought to try to stick up any bank with a wheelchair, much less a defective wheelchair.
Hmm. Now, as you know, Peter, we are up here in Canada, and we often like to remind you fine folks down south that sometimes we tend to be a little more progressive earlier than you are. For instance, as you know, the Supreme Court recently allowed gay marriage across the board in the United States, something we've had in Canada for over a decade. Something else I understand is happening in your country. JetBlue has started round-trip service from JFK Airport to Cuba. Something else we've done for years, by the way, but nice of you to join us.
Well, first of all, only 2% of the population in the United States is gay. Ooh, what a surprise that is. Everybody usually says 20%, 30%. Nah, it's just it's a group of people. They happen to be very noisy. So as far as New York City was concerned, nobody here in New York City really cared. It was an infinitesimal portion of the society. It still is. And if a gay person wanted to get married, they could get married. So the Supreme Court was meaningless to us, other than there's an argument going on as to whether that's the function of the legislature or that's the function of the courts. So that was no big deal. As far as the going to Cuba, New York City has a huge Cuban population who all ran away from Cuba and hate Fidel with a passion. So they weren't too happy, right, the renewing of these relations. But on the other hand, it's going to put a crimp in the biggest business that the Cubans in New York have, and that's smuggling goods into Cuba. Before this, if somebody in Cuba wanted something, they would figure out a way to smuggle it to them in Cuba. Now, since there's not going to be any need for smuggling, it's going to put the smugglers out of business. So it's a decision that was made with a lot of mixed emotions.
Hmm. And finally, one other story I want to get to is I understand that there's a restaurant that's been withholding tips to its employees. That doesn't sound right.
Nah, it's wrong, it's criminal, and it shouldn't be done. And the way we generally do it in New York is if you go into a restaurant in New York, you get the bill, you want to pay by credit card, that's fine. But then what you do is you hand the server the tip in cash. That serves two purposes. First of all, it's a personal way of saying thank you. And second of all, it's your insurance that he's going to get his money. What was happening in that restaurant is that people were adding money to the credit card bill, and the bosses weren't giving it along to the waiters. So that's not going to happen in that restaurant anymore. And I think people are going to start to make more attention. So anyway, pay attention to my advice. You go to a restaurant in New York, give the guy a few bucks in cash as the tip.
And by the way, that was a high-end restaurant, right?
That was what?
That was a high-end restaurant, right?
Yeah, well, because the tips are big. You know, how much money can you cheat when it's a small little diner?
Absolutely. Sir, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I should say, before we say goodbye, a belated 4th of July to you. I hope you had a good holiday and things are happening and bustling in New York City for the summer.
Well, thank you, and it is. The city is absolutely booming.
Have yourself a good one, sir.
Take care. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just into the home stretch here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We have time for one more item, and you know what that is, boys and girls. Yes, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A teenage boy band member was hospitalized after collapsing on board a plane suffering from heat exhaustion. James McElvar boarded an EasyJet flight from Stansted to Glasgow with his fellow Rewind bandmates. But upon being told that he would have to pay an excess luggage fee for an additional bag filled with clothes, he instead opted to wear every single item and save himself 45 pounds. According to The Sun, the 19-year-old boarded the plane wearing a perspiration-inducing 6 t-shirts, 4 jumpers, 3 pairs of jeans, 2 pairs of sweatpants, 2 jackets, and 2 hats. The heat soon got to McElvar, who hurriedly began shedding layers as soon as the plane was airborne, but it was too late. Already sweating profusely and feeling lightheaded, McElvar was violently ill at 37,000 feet. He eventually passed out and was laid in the recovery position in the aisle by an off-duty paramedic who happened to be on the same flight. McElvar said, "I knew something was wrong early on as I just couldn't breathe properly. I thought I was having a heart attack. It was a nightmare. I passed out twice and was taken off the plane at Glasgow Airport to a waiting ambulance." Yeah, I'll bet the use of the ambulance will cost more than 45 pounds, by the way. Now, why, oh why, would someone be so cheap as to wear 12 layers of clothing on a flight, risking heat exhaustion just to avoid a luggage fee? Well, one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0308. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0308. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberstationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.